Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. We're standing by to go to the White House for live coverage of a news conference by President Obama. It is largely expected to focus on the historic Iran nuclear agreement announced Tuesday. As time allows, we'll begin our program with an analyst's view of the deal.
He has a special distinction. His record is the longest consecutive number one in the UK from a Jamaican artist.
The Iran nuclear agreement continues to be our top story, and my colleague Jeffrey Young joins me with some expert analysis. Welcome, Jeffrey. What have you been up to?
Well, yes, Susan, Steve Andreasen at the NGO Nuclear Threat Initiative told me that further engagement between the two countries may indeed take place now.
In the long term, this agreement may allow Iran and the United States to develop formulas that reduce tensions in other regions, or I should say in other areas on other issues. It's certainly not a given, and it's certainly going to take time. And I think the President and the Secretary of State have made clear that the process of building cooperation and trust with Iran has only started with this agreement in Vienna and is going to take many years to unfold. So, having said that, you can also say that it is certainly less likely to develop cooperative approaches with Iran on a broader set of issues in the absence of this agreement and if Iran were to go forward with nuclear weapons. So again, in assessing this agreement that was just struck in Vienna, it really is an agreement that's meant to restrict Iran's nuclear program. And that's the benchmark against which it should be measured. But there are broader issues with respect to U.S.-Iranian relations that could possibly unfold more positively in the years ahead if this agreement goes forward and is successfully implemented.
Very shortly after the agreement was announced, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, came out and made very angry statements. I am quoting Mr. Netanyahu right now, saying that initial reports indicate the concessions were made, in his words, in all areas that were supposed to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons capability. He went on to say, in addition, Iran will receive hundreds of billions of dollars with which it can fuel its terror machine and its expansion and aggression throughout the Middle East and across the globe. I just wanted to get your reaction to Mr. Netanyahu in that statement.
Well, the Israeli Prime Minister has consistently opposed the administration's approach with respect to Iran and the negotiation of this agreement. So what he said is not new, and it's no surprise. Again, you have to ask, what is the alternative to this agreement? It's not some other agreement, nor is it continuing the current freeze on Iran's nuclear program. Rather, it's a situation where, in the absence of this agreement, there would be no agreement, and support for international sanctions would weaken because it would be the United States who was perceived as scuttling a negotiated accord. Again, Iran is not likely to stand still in that instance. They're likely to press forward with their program. And at some point, that is going to force a decision in the United States as to whether or not to use force against the Iranian nuclear program. And recognizing what the Prime Minister said, there are very few analysts who think right now that the situation in the Middle East would be better if the United States and Iran were at war.
We also have the situation of this agreement coming to Washington and going to Capitol Hill. And we're in a presidential election cycle, so there are partisan interests that are in play on any issue, and this issue especially included. Now, the United States, when it imposed sanctions upon Iran, did so through Congress. Won't it take congressional approval to remove those sanctions, at least on the U.S. side?
The process that will play out now over the next 60 days is that the administration is required by law to submit this agreement to Congress for congressional review. Congress will have 60 days to conduct that review and has three possible actions. One, it can vote to approve the agreement in the House and the Senate. Secondly, it can vote to disapprove the agreement. Or thirdly, it can take no action. If there's a vote of disapproval in the House and the Senate, the president can veto that disapproval, and then Congress has time to override that veto. But of course, it would take two-thirds in the House and the Senate to override the presidential veto. The bottom line is, for this deal to go through, the president really needs to have 34 senators who support him and would sustain a veto.
That was Steve Andreasen, national security consultant at the NGO Nuclear Threat Initiative.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Let's see if Steve is right, Susan.
Michael Lippin is here for a look at social media commentary on the Iran nuclear deal. Michael, what is the big Iran hashtag on Twitter today?
Hey, Susan. Well, you know, hashtag Iran deal is still the big one. It's been used 98,000 times in the last 24 hours. It's according to the analytics website Topsy. That's down from about 172,000 tweets the previous day. British newspaper The Guardian used hashtag Iran deal to tweet a link to a colorful story about the festivities in Iran following the deal's announcement. Its tweet said, Iranian authorities were unusually tolerant of the all-singing, all-dancing Iran deal celebrations. I also saw a tweet from Foreign Policy magazine, whose handle is @foreignpolicy. It promoted a column by arms control analyst Jeffrey Lewis, whose own handle is @armscontrolwonk. Foreign Policy quoted Lewis as saying, "Don't listen to the naysayers right now. It's a damn good Iran deal." Well, one of those naysayers or critics is former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney. U.S. political news website The Hill tweeted a story about remarks that Cheney made in an interview with the Fox News TV network. The Hill tweeted this ominous quote from Cheney, hashtag Iran deal moves us closer to nuclear war. Susan?
Thanks, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Flight controllers at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physical Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, celebrated as history was made on Tuesday, July 14th at 11:49 UTC, when NASA's New Horizons spacecraft made its closest approach to Pluto. The New Horizons is the fastest spacecraft that has ever been launched. It's hurtling through the Pluto system at more than 53,000 kilometers per hour. After traveling nearly a decade, some 5 billion kilometers into the far reaches of our solar system, the first craft to be sent to Pluto flew within 12,500 kilometers above the surface of the dwarf planet. Once New Horizons processes all the information from the flyby, it will send back nearly 10 years worth of data it has gathered since its mission began in January 2006. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Iraq announced the start of an offensive to recapture its western Anbar province from Islamic State militants who control large areas of the region, including the cities of Ramadi and Fallujah. A U.S.-led campaign of airstrikes targets the Islamic State group, which is seeking an Islamic caliphate in Syria and Iraq. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy attended a panel discussion organized by the newly established Atlantic Council's Middle East Strategy Task Force to explore the role of religion in the rise of extremist groups like the Islamic State group. And he joins us now here in the studio. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, Sue.
What did the discussion lead to?
Well, the co-chair of this task force is former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She indicated in the discussion that world events has been shaped by several factors, including religion, which is now replacing the threat of nuclear exchange during the Cold War.
Today, perhaps our worst nightmare is that religion will ignite fears and conflicts that we will be unable to contain. Nowhere is this risk greater than in the Middle East, where the people of the region are looking for answers on how to deal with the threat posed by extremists who, acting in the name of God, try to impose their will on others.
But did Secretary Albright feel that religion is to be blamed for the spread of violent groups like ISIS in the region?
No, Sue. She said that blaming Islam for that is a very simplistic approach, because it's not the teachings of Islam to be blamed, but manipulating the religion to recruit young people to fight with the Islamic State.
Religion is a powerful force whose impact depends entirely on what it inspires people to do. And the challenge for those in the region is to harness the unifying potential of faith while containing its capacity to divide.
But Geneva Abdo, chairman of the Atlantic Council's Working Group on Religion and Countering Violent Extremism, argued that the impact of religion on extremism varies depending on the different interpretations of Islam.
The first thing we have to determine is which Islam, because there are many interpretations of the faith, and most Muslims do not practice the Islam as it's practiced by ISIS. But ISIS does instrumentalize religion to try to get recruits, to try to set up what it calls a caliphate. And so obviously there are some people following ISIS who do believe it is about religion or ideology.
If that is the case, then who exactly bears the responsibility of countering this ideology?
Genevieve Abdo believes that it's very difficult to think of the remedies. However, she said, the most effective remedy has to come from within the Islamic world itself. She recommends pressuring governments like Saudi Arabia and other conservative Islamic countries to stop funding radical groups and also reform the religious educational systems. As for the religious scholars' role, she calls on them to figure out strategies to become more relevant to young Muslims and start to use social media to counter extremist ideologies. Genevieve Abdo pointed out to a crucial factor that radicalizes the non-radicals, as she said, which is repression and political exclusion.
Egypt is a perfect example of this. Since the government of El-Sisi came to power, it's become so repressive that look at the extremism in Egypt now. And it's not only extremism in Sinai or in Upper Egypt. It is extremist among youth that didn't necessarily support the Muslim Brotherhood, but agreed with their ideas. And they have also become extremists. So it is very clear that extremist policies, repression by states, produces more extremism.
That was Genevieve Abdo, chairman of Atlantic Council's Working Group on Religion and Countering Violent Extremism.
Mohammed, thank you for such an extensive array of views.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, we hope to bring you a live news conference by President Obama at the White House, where he's expected to focus on the Iran nuclear deal. Officials in the northwest U.S. state of Alaska today are launching an ambitious new phase of their cleanup of the state's massive shoreline, including hundreds of tons of tsunami debris from Japan's 2011 earthquake. The operation, including funding from federal and state resources, as well as $5 million donation from Japan, will include a barge and helicopters picking up debris already stored in super sturdy sacks above the high tide line. The debris includes remnants of docks, fishing buoys, refrigerators, building and boat fragments, and shipping containers that has been washed or blown ashore along thousands of kilometers of U.S. and Canadian shoreline. Officials say it has created an unsightly environmental hazard affecting marine and land wildlife. Jonna Stewart of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation told my colleague Victor Beatty the location of cleanup operations is a result of the taking of thousands of pictures by aerial survey along the coastline. And she says identifying what may have come from Japan depends largely on the years of expertise of marine debris contractors.
They had been doing debris work for a number of years, including prior to the tsunami. And their experience indicates that in the years following the tsunami, there were periods of time on certain beaches where more than 50% of the debris that was coming in was tsunami-related. Now, it's difficult to identify individual objects, and NOAA, which is administering these funds, has very specific criteria for identifying objects that are tsunami. You have to be able to prove that the object was at a site in Japan prior to the tsunami and then can be specifically identified when it's on the beaches. So there aren't a lot of items that have gone through that rigorous certification, but because of the nature of the debris, particularly oyster buoys that are common to Japan and were common in the area where the tsunami came through, certain types of foam and that are used in Japanese construction, some of the later arriving debris, the heavier debris, is Japanese dimensional lumber, which is identified because it's uniquely different from American dimensional lumber.
The tsunami was 4 years ago. Has this all been collecting since then, or have you had periodic cleanups?
There have been cleanups. There have been periodic cleanups for a number of years. They haven't all been funded with this Japanese gift money.
Are any Japanese officials or cleanup crews involved, and will any of the Japanese-related materials be returned to Japan?
The only items that have been returned to Japan have been individual items that appear to have either personal or cultural or historical value. There was a soccer ball that was found that was able to be sent back to the school where it came from. There's been some small individual items. There have been a number of Japanese folks who have come over and have worked on as volunteers on some of the crews. We did receive some gift funding from a consortium of Japanese engineers who basically put out a tip jar at a conference in Japan, and individuals contributed funds.
How much debris are we actually talking about, and how long will this process take?
This particular barge process is going to be about 1 month from the time it lands in Kodiak until the time it reaches Seattle. The debris that's being picked up in dozens of locations has been collected over this year, last year, and a few places the years before.
So this is all heading for Seattle for sorting, recycling, and disposal?
That's correct.
Disposal in Oregon, is that what I understand?
Yeah, the waste management, the final waste management disposal facility is in Arlington, Oregon, so the debris will be offloaded at the Duwamish River site, on the waste management site in Seattle. It'll then go to a sort line where some nonprofit organizations are going to try to do some sorting and selecting of the debris that can be used for recycling. And then the rest of it will all go to the final disposal site in Oregon. We don't have landfills in Alaska that can handle this kind of quantity.
Stewart says Alaska's shoreline is often remote with what she calls high-energy beaches with dangerous currents, requiring debris extraction by helicopter to the offshore barge. Most debris from the earthquake tsunami March 11, 2011, sank off Japan's coast, but an estimated 1.5 million tons were carried across the Pacific Ocean by wind and currents. It looks like now it's time for our special coverage at the White House.
This is a live special report from the Voice of America. I'm Jeffrey Young in Washington. President Obama is holding a news conference at the White House. This a day after a historic nuclear deal with Iran was reached in Vienna after months of negotiation. We've heard the details of the agreement the last day or so, in the last 24 hours since the agreement was reached. Now, the president is expected to further discuss the fine points of the agreement, as well as take a lot of questions about what he plans to do to get this through Congress. In order for this deal to be sealed on the United States side, Congress has put itself in a position of a 60-day review so that it can look at the agreement and make a decision. Will it approve it? Will it disapprove it? Or will it take no action at all? We don't have any specific ideas on that at the moment, but political pundits are saying that in order for the president to survive any action by Congress that would turn this deal down, he has to hold on to 34 senators. As long as he has 34 senators who will not vote against the agreement, then he can override any veto, or rather he can override a veto and get the agreement passed and on the books on the United States side. Obviously, in Iran, it's a different deal entirely. That's not the issue. What is important is getting this through Congress. And there are people who are raising concerns about this, even on the Democratic side. One of them is Democratic Senator Chris Coons from the state of Delaware, who has said Iran has seriously earned our distrust. Congress does indeed have a 60-day review period for this agreement, and it could be even longer because of the August recess before we have any resolution on this. Senate Minority Whip Dick Durbin, a Democrat, said of his fellow Democratic colleagues, they are getting a lot of pressure from constituents who are suspicious of any agreement. But again, there are more Democrats in support of this agreement than against it. So that hopes, at least on the White House side, that they should be able to get this agreement through and on the books. We are still waiting for the president to approach the podium. According to several sources, key Democrats are so far holding back support for the Iran deal, reportedly because they're worried that the plan would undermine national security, may pose a threat to Israel, which has vocally opposed the agreement as it was announced, and, according to some people, allow Iran to escape economic sanctions. There is a contingent on Capitol Hill that even to this day, with the agreement announced, is still speaking in terms of sanctions. Now we join the President of the United States.
Please have a seat. Good afternoon, everybody. Yesterday was a historic day. The comprehensive long-term deal that we achieved with our allies and partners to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon represents a powerful display of American leadership and diplomacy. It shows what we can accomplish when we lead from a position of strength and a position of principle, when we unite the international community around a shared vision, and we resolve to solve problems peacefully. As I said yesterday, it's important for the American people and Congress to get a full opportunity to review this deal. That process is now underway. I've already reached out to leaders in Congress on both sides of the aisle. My national security team has begun offering extensive briefings. I expect the debate to be robust, and that's how it should be. This is an important issue. Our national security policies are stronger and more effective when they are subject to the scrutiny and transparency that democracy demands. And as I said yesterday, the details of this deal matter very much. That's why our team worked so hard for so long to get the details right. At the same time, as this debate unfolds, I hope we don't lose sight of the larger picture, the opportunity that this agreement represents. As we go forward, it's important for everybody to remember the alternative and the fundamental choice that this moment represents. With this deal, we cut off every single one of Iran's pathways to a nuclear program, a nuclear weapons program. And Iran's nuclear program will be under severe limits for many years. Without a deal, those pathways remain open. There would be no limits to Iran's nuclear program, and Iran could move closer to a nuclear bomb. With this deal, we gain unprecedented, around-the-clock monitoring of Iran's key nuclear facilities and the most comprehensive and intrusive inspection and verification regime ever negotiated. Without a deal, those inspections go away, and we lose the ability to closely monitor Iran's program and detect any covert nuclear weapons program. With this deal, if Iran violates its commitments, there will be real consequences. Nuclear-related sanctions that have helped to cripple the Iranian economy will snap back into place. Without a deal, the international sanctions regime will unravel, with little ability to reimpose them. With this deal, we have the possibility of peacefully resolving a major threat to regional and international security. Without a deal, we risk even more war in the Middle East, and other countries in the region would feel compelled to pursue their own nuclear programs, threatening a nuclear arms race in the most volatile region in the world. As I said yesterday, even with this deal, we will continue to have profound differences with Iran, its support of terrorism, its use of proxies to destabilize parts of the Middle East. Therefore, the multilateral arms embargo on Iran will remain in place for an additional 5 years, and restrictions on ballistic missile technology will remain for 8 years. In addition, the United States will maintain our own sanctions related to Iran's support for terrorism, its ballistic missile program, its human rights violations, and will continue our unprecedented security cooperation with Israel and continue to deepen our partnerships with the Gulf states. But the bottom line is this. This nuclear deal meets the national security interests of the United States and our allies. It prevents the most serious threat, Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon, which would only make the other problems that Iran may cause even worse. That's why this deal makes our country and the world safer and more secure. It's why the alternative, no limits on Iran's nuclear